During my classroom visits for National Wildlife Refuge Week a few weeks back, I talked about how refuges came about in the first place. The first refuge, Pelican Island, came into being through a perfect storm of unregulated overhunting, bird populations susceptible to such hunting, an unquenchable market, and a newly dawning public awareness that such impacts could be long-lasting or even fatal. The plume trade, the collection of feathers from large shore and water birds for women's fashions, was gigantic. Legions of hunters sought to make their fortune through the harvest of as many such birds as they could manage to kill, using specialized devices and firearms designed to take out whole flocks of birds. It was both unregulated and legal. Most often no limits or seasons existed, so it was legal to take down large numbers of such birds. I would note that legal doesn't always mean right. A few citizens, concerned about extinction events for a number of species, sought to get some government protections in place. And they did. Pelican Island became the first refuge by the hand of President Theodore Roosevelt, who also created over 50 more before leaving office. To get across the idea of limits and regulations, as opposed to how it was back then, during my class visits I mentioned that I'm looking forward to winter moose season. I asked the kids how many moose I can shoot. In every instance, across kids of all ages, they knew the limit was one, which made me smile. Today, let's talk a bit about things such as limits and regulations and why they're needed, particularly in our present time. Welcome to Bristol Bay Field Notes. I'm Terry Fuller, Education Specialist for Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. Before getting started, I acknowledge there are or can be exceptions to that one moose thing. Some game management units sometimes allow for more than one, and some folks hunt on proxy tags for those who can't hunt. But in a general sort of way, for most hunters in most areas, a single moose is it. Also, and shifting to one of the directions we're headed today, the extinction of a species isn't something that's just limited to the dinosaurs. No, there are an ample amount of much more recent examples, with, in many cases, a pretty clear reason for why those extinctions occurred. Allow me to share a few of those. The dodo is a large flightless bird that has been parodied some through the years, such as in movies. For example, the dodo sequence in the movie Ice Age is hilarious, in my humble opinion. The dodo is very much a more recent extinction example, with its demise happening in the very late 1600s. That might not seem very recent, but on a scale of Earth's history, it's very recent indeed. Dodos did not go extinct completely because of overhunting, though it did likely play a part in it. Their end was also a result of being geographically isolated, meaning populations were contained. And then, when they first met with humans, they were fearless of them. Add to the fact that they were flightless, and it made them easy prey for sailors and other predators that were introduced in following years, such as dogs, pigs, cats, and rats, which preyed not only on the adults, but on eggs as well. Much more recently, in 1936, the largest carnivorous marsupial, well, think on that collection of words for a moment, of the time, the thylacine became extinct. This critter had the head of a dog, the stripes of a cat, and the pouch of a kangaroo. Its more common name was the Tasmanian tiger. They became hated by farmers, who blamed them heavily for livestock losses. As such, killing them was not just an acceptable thing, but was also actively encouraged. In the early to mid-1800s, some companies put out bounties on them. By the end of the century, the Tasmanian government was paying to have them exterminated. In 1936, the last known Tasmanian tiger, named Benjamin, died at the Hobart Zoo. I say last known, but in the years since, many possible sightings have happened on the Australian mainland, and some with credible photos. Still, it has not been officially established that Tasmanian tigers still exist. Let's consider a more recent example, closer to home and the partial subject of a previous Field Notes episode, the passenger pigeon. This is a great species to consider because it did go extinct so recently and also because there were so many of them that it's not only hard to believe that they went extinct, but did so in such a sudden fashion. At one time, it's believed that passenger pigeons constituted up to 40% of the total bird population of the entire United States. When European colonization first began, the total population might have exceeded 5 billion birds. And yet the last one died in a zoo in 1914. Their downfall, it is believed, was a toxic combination of overhunting, a failed survival strategy, at least where humans are concerned, and absolutely no conservation efforts to put the brakes on what was a cratering population in the late 1800s. There was a huge commercial market for the birds, as they were reportedly terrific table fare, so hunters slaughtered them until there were no more. In the case of the passenger pigeon, it really is that simple. It's very much a real-life parallel to what happens in the Lorax with the truffula trees. Again, it staggers the mind to accept that there are no more. A single nesting site in Wisconsin during the mid-1800s was reported to have covered 850 square miles, with a nesting population of almost 1.5 million birds, that according to a leading ornithologist at the time. And today, not a single living bird is left. One more example, and one from our continent, although this one is a success story too. The American bison, also commonly known as the American buffalo or simply buffalo, is a North American bison species that once covered much of our continent and in simply staggering numbers. From Alaska to the Gulf of Mexico and east as far as the Atlantic seaboard, bison were just simply everywhere. Even after Europeans began settling in North America, the population was thought to be in excess of 60 million animals, as late as the end of the 1700s. Let me put that in different terms. That's 24 times the population of moose in Alaska. Just a century later, 1889 to be precise, the bison population was down to 541 animals, and sure seemed like it was headed to extinction. While a great many reasons exist for that decline, overhunting was certainly one of them. Today, between wild and ranched bison, that number across our continent is estimated at something like 400,000. And we have our own success story here in Alaska, with the release of wood bison up north near the Innoko River a few years back. At this point, this may seem like it's something of an anti-hunting plug. Quite the opposite. There is no outdoor activity that I enjoy participating in more than hunting, and it's been a part of my life for as long as I can remember. I am eagerly looking forward to the winter season, plotting and scheming even now where I'll go and how I'll approach it. I very much am hopeful for a real winter, too, to be able to get out and hunt things such as caribou, ptarmigan, and hares in a typical winter-type fashion. And I have a trip to Africa planned for the spring. No, I'm very much in favor of hunting, as I know the preponderance of people around here are. I grew up in the middle of the lower 48 during a time when hunting was almost wholly acceptable and access to private land to hunt an easy thing to gain. I had permission to probably hundreds of separate private lands during the ages of maybe 10 or so through my early adult years. That's just not the reality anymore. Access is harder to acquire as private landowners commonly lease out access for hunting. Also, even in places that traditionally have been strongholds for hunting, anti-hunting mindsets and biases are creeping in. It is an easily proven fact that, for the United States human population, numbers continue to climb, much of that found in urban areas. Also, hunter participation numbers continue to drop, and anti-hunting bias continues to grow. That can show itself in many ways, such as restrictions on specific weapons, decreased areas to hunt, and the elimination of peripherally related activities, such as trapping. This is the direction things currently seem to be moving. It might not feel like it matters to us in rural Alaska, but it does. Like everything else, if it continues, it'll find its way to us. I'm running out of time for this week's episode, so let me conclude or get to where I was heading as quickly as I can. Our lives here, as hunters and users of our outdoor resources, revolve around the seasons. Winter moose season is coming up. If conditions are decent, you can throw in winter caribou as well. The caribou seasons have become an evolving entity and hot topic, as biologists seek to get a grasp on what's going on with the Mulchetna herd. The rise and fall of such herds can be something for us to ponder, and I'm not trying to sound a death knell for that particular herd. Just point out that such resources require good stewardship to ensure that they not just have a future, but a brighter one at that. On an individual basis, I'd offer up the following as a way to help that happen, while believing pretty much everyone is doing this anyway. My encouragement to you is this, and know that I hold myself to this as well. Pay attention to what we as hunters need to be doing legally and ethically for every season we hunt and every animal we try to harvest. Know what the seasons and limits are, and follow them. Have whatever necessary permits, license, and tags to hunt what you plan to hunt. The laws and regulations in place aren't some random items that were arrived at arbitrarily. They were created through the combined input of a whole lot of people, including the public at large. They exist to offer people opportunities to hunt while ensuring the future of the resource. If hunting is something you enjoy, even a fraction as much as I do, get out and enjoy it, as you are able. I know that's what I plan to do. And I've made this offer before. If you see me in the field and need a hand, I'm sure I'll have a skinning knife on me. Don't be afraid to ask. In the immortal words of noted philosopher and TV personality Red Green, remember, I'm pulling for you. We're all in this together. For Field Notes, I'm Terry Fuller. Music from Loon Echo Lake provided courtesy of Solitudes at www.solitudes.com.